Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Ladies in Waiting by Hugh B. Cave. Helper, the village real estate man, said with a squint, "You're the same people looked at that place back in April, aren't you?" "Sure you are. The ones got caught in that freak snowstorm and spent the night there. Mr. and Mrs. Wilkes, is it?" "Wilkins," Norman corrected, frowning at a photograph on the wall of the old man's dingy office, a yellow, fly-spotted picture of the house itself, in all its decay and drabness. "And you want to look at it again?" "Yes," Linda exclaimed. Both men looked at her sharply because of her vehemence. Norman, her husband, was alarmed anew by the eagerness that suddenly flamed in her lovely brown eyes, and as suddenly was replaced by a look of guilt. Yes, unmistakably a look of guilt. "I mean," she stammered, "we still want a big old house that we can do over, Mr. Helper. We've never stopped looking, and we keep thinking the Creighton place just might do." "You keep thinking it might do," Norman silently corrected. He himself had intensely disliked the place when Halper showed it to them 4 months ago. The sharp edge of his abhorrence was not even blunted, and time would never dull his remembrance of that shocking expression on Linda's face when he stepped through the 170-year-old doorway again. He would hate and fear the house as much as before, he was certain. Would he again see that look on his wife's face? God forbid. "Well," Halper said, "there's no need for me to go along with you this time, I guess. I'll just ask you to return the key when you're through, same as you did before." Norman accepted the tag key from him and walked unhappily out to the car. It was 4 miles from the village to the house, 1 mile of narrow blacktop, 3 of a dirt road that seemed forlorn and forgotten even in this neglected part of New England. At 3 in the afternoon of an awesomely hot August day, the car made the only sound in a deep green silence. The sun's heat had robbed even birds and insects of their voices. Norman was silent, too, with apprehension. Beside him, his adored wife of less than 2 years leaned forward to peer through the windshield for the first glimpse of their destination, seeming to have forgotten he existed. Only the house now mattered. And there it was. Nothing had changed. It was big and ugly, with a sagging front piazza and too few windows. It was old. It was gray because almost all its white paint had weathered away. According to old Halper, the Creightons had lived here for generations, having come here from Salem, where one of their women in the days of witchcraft madness had been hanged for practicing demonology. A likely story. As he stopped the car by the piazza steps, Norman glanced at the girl beside him, his beloved, his childhood sweetheart. Why in God's name was she eager to come here again? She had not been so in the beginning. For days after that harrowing ordeal, she had been depressed, unwilling even to talk about it. But then weeks later, the change. Oh yes, the change. So subtle at first, or at least as subtle as her unsophisticated nature could contrive. "Norm, do you remember that old house we were snowbound in? Do you suppose we might have liked it if things had been different?" Then not so subtle. "Norm, can we look at the Creighton place again? Please, Norm?" As he fumbled the key into the lock, he reached for her hand. "Are you all right, hon?" "Of course." The same tone of voice she had used in Halper's shabby office. Impatient. Critical. "Don't ask silly questions." With a premonition of disaster, he pushed the old door open. It was the same. Furnished, Halper had called it, trying to be facetious. There were dusty ruins of furniture and carpets, and yes, someone or something was using them, that the house had not been empty for 8 years, as Halper claimed. Now the feeling returned as Norman trailed his wife through the downstairs rooms and up the staircase to the bedchambers above. But the feeling was strong. He wanted desperately to seize her hand again and shout, "No, no, darling, come out of here." Upstairs, when she halted in the big front bedroom, turning slowly to look about her, he said helplessly, "Hon, please, what is it? What do you want?" No answer. He had ceased to exist. She even bumped into him as she went past to sit on the old four-poster with its mildewed mattress, and seated there she stared emptily into space, as she had done before. He went to her and took her hands. "Linda, for God's sake, what is it with this place?" She looked up and smiled at him. "I'm all right. Don't worry, darling." There had been an old blanket on the bed when they entered this room before. He had thought of wrapping her in it because she was shivering. The house was frigid, and with a car trapped in deepening snow, they would have to spend the night here. But the blanket reeked with age, and she had cringed from the touch of it. Then, "Wait," he had said with a flash of inspiration. "Maybe if I could jam this under a tire? Come on, it's at least worth a try." "I'm cold, Norm. Let me stay here." "You'll be all right? Not scared?" "Better scared than frozen." "Well, I won't be long." How long was he gone? 10 minutes? 20? Twice the car had seemed about to pull free from the snow's mushy grip. Twice the wheel had spun the sodden blanket out from under and sent it flying through space like a huge yellow bird, and he'd been forced to go groping after it with a frigid wind lashing his half-frozen face. Say 20 minutes. Certainly no longer. Then, giving it up as a bad job, he had trudged despondently back to the house and climbed the stairs again to that front bedroom. And there she sat on the bed, as she was sitting now, white as the snow itself, wide-eyed, staring at or into something that only she could see. "Linda, what's wrong?" "Nothing, nothing." He grasped her shoulders. "Look at me. Stop staring like that. What's happened?" "I thought I heard something. Saw something." "Saw what?" "I don't know. I don't remember." Lifting her from the bed, he put his arms about her and glowered defiantly at the empty doorway. Strange. A paper-thin layer of mist or smoke moved along the floor there, drifting out into the hall, and there were floating shapes of the same darkish stuff trapped in the room's corners as though left behind when the chamber had emptied itself of a larger mass. Or was he imagining these things? One moment they seemed to be there, a moment later they were gone. And was he also imagining the odor? It had not been present in the musty air of this room before. It certainly seemed to be now, unless his senses were playing tricks on him. A peculiarly robust smell, unquestionably male. But now it was fading. Never mind. There was someone in this house, by God. He had felt an alien presence when Halper was here, even more so after the agent's departure. Someone, something, following them about, watching them. The back of Linda's dress was unzipped, he realized then. His hands, pressing her to him, suddenly found themselves inside the garment on her body. And her body was cold, colder than the snow he had struggled with outside. Cold and clammy. The zipper. He fumbled for it, found it drawn all the way down. What in God's name had she tried to do? This was his wife who loved him. This was a girl who only a few weeks ago at the club had savagely slapped the face of the town's richest, handsomest playboy for daring to hint at a mate-swapping arrangement. Slowly he drew the zipper up again, then held her at arm's length and looked again at her face. She seemed unaware he had touched her, or that he even existed. She was entirely alone, still gazing into that secret world in which he had no place. The rest of that night had seemed endless. Linda lying on the bed, he sitting beside her waiting for daylight. She seemed to sleep some of the time. At other times, though, she said nothing, even when spoken to. He sensed she was as wide awake as he. While 4 o'clock, the wind died and the snow stopped, its wet slapping of the window panes. No dawn had ever been more welcome, even though he was still unable to free the car, and they both had to walk to the village to send a tow truck for it. And now he had let her persuade him to come back here. He must be insane. Norman? She sat there on the bed, the same bed, but at least she was looking at him now, not through him, into that secret world of hers. Norman? You do like this house a little, don't you? If you mean, could I ever seriously think of living here? Emphatically, he shook his head. My God, no. It gives me the horrors. It's really a lovely old house, Norman. We could work on it little by little. Do you think I'm crazy? If you can even imagine living in this mausoleum, I know you're crazy. My God, woman, you were nearly frightened out of your wits here, in this very room, too. Was I, Norman, really? Yes, you were. If I live to be 100, I'll never stop seeing that look on your face. What kind of look was it, Norman? I don't know. That's just it. I don't know. What in heaven's name were you seeing when I walked back in here after my session with the car? What was that mist, that smell? Smiling, she reached for his hand. I don't remember any mist or smell, Norman. I was just a little frightened. I told you I thought I heard something. You saw something, too, you said. Did I say that? I've forgotten. Still smiling, she looked around the room, at the garden of faded roses on shreds of time-stained wallpaper, at the shabby bureau with its solitary broken, cut glass vase. Old Mr. Halper was to blame for what happened, Norman. His talk of demons. Halper didn't do that much talking, Linda. Well, he told us about the woman who was hanged in Salem. I can see now, of course, that he threw that out as bait, because I had told him you write mystery novels. He probably pictured sitting in this some sort of Dracula cape, scratching out your books with a quill by lamplight, and thought this would be a marvelous setting for it. Her soft laugh was a welcome sound, reminding Norman he loved this girl, and she loved him, that their life together, except for inexplicable interest in this house, was full of gentleness and caring. But he could not let her win this debate. Linda, listen, if this is such a fine old house, why has it been empty for 8 years? Well, Mr. Halper explained that, Norman. Did he? I don't seem to recall any explanation. He said that the last person to live here was a woman who died 8 years ago at 93. Her married name was Stanhope, I think he said, but she was a Creighton. She even had the same given name, Prudence, as a woman hanged in Salem for worshipping demons. And when she passed away, there was some legal question about the property because her husband had died some years before in an asylum, leaving no will. Norman reluctantly nodded. The truth was, he hadn't paid much attention to the real estate man's talk, but he did recall the remark that the last man of the house had been committed to an asylum for the insane. Probably from having lived in such a gloomy old house for so long, he had thought at the time. Annoyed with himself for having lost the debate, at least for not having won it, he turned from the bed and walked to a window where he stood gazing down at the yard. Right down there 4 months ago was where he had struggled to free the car. Frowning at the spot now, he suddenly said aloud, "Wait, that's damn queer." "What is, dear?" Linda said from the bed. "I've always thought we left the car in a low spot that night. A spot where the snow must have drifted extra deep, I mean. But we didn't. We were in the highest part of the yard. Perhaps the ground is soft there." "Uh-huh. It's rocky." "Then it might have been slippery." "Well, I suppose." Suddenly he pressed closer to the window glass. "Oh, damn. We've got a flat." "What, Norman?" "A flat. Those are new tires, too. We must have picked up a nail on our way into this stupid place." Striding back to the bed, he caught her hand. "Come on. I'm not leaving you here this time." She did not protest. Obediently, she followed him downstairs and along the lower hall to the front door. On the piazza, she hesitated, briefly glancing back at what seemed to be a moment of panic. But when he again grasped her hand, she meekly went down with him down the steps and out to the car. The left front tire was the flat one. Hunkering down beside it, he searched for the culprit nail but failed to find any. It was underneath, no doubt. Things like flat tires always annoyed him. In a properly organized world, they wouldn't happen. Of course, in such a world, there would not be the kind of road one has to travel to reach this place, nor would it be such an impossible house to begin with. Muttering to himself, he opened a trunk, extracted jack, tools, and spare, and went to work. Strange. There was no nail in the offending tire, nor cut or bruise either. The tire must have been badly made. The thought did not improve his mood, as on his knees he wrestled the spare into place. Then when he lowered the jack, the spare gently flattened under the car's weight, and he knelt there staring at it in disbelief. What the hell? Nothing like this had ever happened to him before. He jacked the car back up again, took the spare off, and examined it. No nail, no break, no bruise. It was a new tire like the others. Newer because never yet used. It had a repair kit for tubeless tires in the trunk, he recalled. Bought one day on an impulse. Repair puncture in minutes without even taking the tire off the car. But how could you repair puncture that wasn't there? Linda, this is crazy. We'll have to walk back to town as we did before. He turned his head. Linda? She was not there. He lurched to his feet. Linda, where are you? How long had she been gone? He must have been working on the car for 15 or 20 minutes. She hadn't spoken in that time, he suddenly realized. Had she slipped back into the house the moment he became absorbed in his task? She knew well enough how intensely concentrated on such things. How when he was writing, for instance, she could walk through the room without his even knowing it. Linda, for God's sakes, no! Hoarsely shouting her name, he stumbled toward the house. The door clattered open when he flung himself against it, and the sound filled his ears as he staggered down the hall. But now the hall was not just an ancient, dusty corridor. It was a dim tunnel, filled with premature darkness and strange whisperings. He knew where she must be. In that cursed room at the top of the stairs, where he had seen the look on her face 4 months ago, and where she had tried so cunningly to conceal the truth from him this time. But the room was hard to reach now. A swirling mist choked the staircase, repeatedly causing him to stumble. Things resembling hands darted out, as if to clutch at him and hold him back. He stopped in confusion, and the hands nudged him forward again. Their owner was playing a game with him, he realized, mocking his frantic efforts to reach the bedroom, yet at the same time seductively urging him to try even harder. And the whisperings made words, or seemed to. Come, Norman. Sweet Norman. Come, come, come. In the upstairs hall, too, the swirling mist challenged him, deepening into a moving mass that hid the door of the room. But he needed no compass to find that door. Gasping and cursing, damn you, leave me alone, get out of my way. He struggled to it and found it open as Linda, and he had left it. Hands outthrust, he groped his way over the threshold. The alien presence here was stronger. The sense of being confronted by some unseen creature was all but overwhelming, yet the assault upon him was less violent now that he had reached the room. The hands groping for him in the eerie darkness were even gentle, caressing. They clung with a velvet softness that was strangely pleasurable, and there was something voluptuously female about them. Even to a faint but pervasive female odor, an odor, not a perfume, a body scent drug-like in its effect upon his senses. Bewildered, he ceased his struggle for a moment to see what would happen. The whispering became an invitation, a promise of incredible delights. But he allowed himself only a moment of listening, and then, shouting Linda's name, hurled himself at the bed again. This time, he was able to reach it. But she was not now sitting there staring into that secret world of hers as he had expected. The bed was empty, and a seductive voice in the darkness softly laughed at his dismay. Come, Norman. Sweet Norman. Come. 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 He felt himself taken from behind by the shoulders, turned, and ever so gently pushed. He fell floating into the old mattress, half-heartedly thrusting up his arms to keep the advancing shadow form from possessing him. But it flowed down over him, onto him, into him. Despite his feeble resistance, and the female smell tantalized his senses again, destroying his will to resist. As he ceased struggling, he heard a sound of rusty hinges creaking in that part of the room's dimness where the door was, and then a soft thud. The door had been closed, but he did not cry out. He felt no alarm. It was good to be here on the bed, luxuriating in the sensuous, caressing softness. As he became quiescent, it flowed over him with unrestrained indulgence, touching and stroking him to heights of ecstasy. Now the unseen hands, having opened his shirt slowly and seductively, glided down his body to his belt. He heard a new sound then. For a moment it bewildered him because, though coming through the ancient wall behind him, from the adjoining bedroom, it placed him at once in his own bedroom at home. Linda and he had joked about it often, as true lovers could, the explosive little syllables to which she always gave voice when making love. So she was content, too. Everything was straightforward and above board then. After all, as that fellow at the club had suggested, mate-swapping was an in thing in this year of our Lord, 1975, wasn't it? All kinds of people did it. He must buy this house, as Linda had insisted, of course. She was absolutely right. With a sigh of happiness, he closed his eyes and relaxed, no longer made reluctant by a feeling of guilt. But something was wrong. Distinctly now, he felt not two hands caressing him, but more. And were they hands? They suddenly seemed cold, clammy, frighteningly eager. Opening his eyes, he was startled to find that the misty darkness had dissolved and he could see. Perhaps the seeing came with total surrender, or with a final abandonment of his guilt feeling. He lay on his back, naked, with his nameless partner half beside him, half on him. He saw her scaly, misshapen breast overflowing his chest, and her monstrous, demonic face swaying in space above his own. And as he screamed, he saw that she did have more than two hands. She had a whole writhing mass of them at the ends of long, searching tentacles. The last thing he saw before his scream became that of a madman was a row of three others like her, squatting by the wall, their tentacles restlessly reaching towards him as they impatiently awaited their turn. Mirror, Mirror by Ray Russell. Alan sold himself to the devil for a mirror. The moment the contract was signed, Alan's front doorbell rang and the devil slipped out the back. When Alan answered the ringing, two thick-thewed deliverymen carried into his house a large, flat, oval-shaped wrap in brown paper. Alan instructed them to bring it into his study and lean it against the south wall. After they left, he locked himself into the study, drew the blinds, and tore the paper off his acquisition. The oval mirror was as tall as Alan, of good quality glass, set in an ormolu frame. It was quite handsome. Alan was pleased. But the image that stared back at him from the glass was obviously displeased. It was merely himself, dressed exactly as the real Alan, in shirt sleeves and pearl gray slacks, but the expression on the face was angry, and the writhing mouth spat three silent syllables, the last of which, Alan deduced from the placement of upper teeth on lower lip, began with an F. Alan grew furious and blurted out, "It's a fraud!" The image in the glass turned its back to Alan and strode out of sight. Alan, perplexed and vexed, turned away from the mirror and left the room. Having carefully relocked the door to his study, Alan now paced the floor outside that room. He furrowed his face, hardened into a mask of bitterness as the truth became clear. He had requested for his private use a magic glass in which he could see the future. The devil had given him precisely that. What Alan had meant was a glass that would foretell all future events, like the crystal ball of fable, magazine, cartoon, and cliché. What conceivably earthly, or for that matter, unearthly value, was a mirror that did no more than reflect an image 5 seconds ahead of time? If the reflection were 24 hours in the future, or even 12, he could put it to some use, hold up newspapers to the mirror, read the next day's racing results and stock market listings. He could win wagers on elections, predict earthquakes and other disasters, beat Broadway critics to the punch, become famous as a prophet, make a lot of money, be praised and feared and sought after. But 5 seconds? Alan howled with rage. The stinking goat had tricked him. He did not sleep all night. He paced, cursed, smoked cigarettes, drank whiskey, drank coffee, scribbled thoughts on paper, tore up the paper in frustration, pounded his head with his fist, formed and rejected a dozen ideas, 24, 100. None of them were any good. He could do nothing with those absurd 5 seconds. The mirror was utterly worthless. As the dawn began to reach hesitantly into his house, he fell into a sleep of total exhaustion. 5 hours later, he awoke, much refreshed and with a new idea in his head. That evening, he would have cause to wonder who had put it there. He made several telephone calls, inviting a variety of people to cocktails in the afternoon. He then phoned a modish caterer to order liquor and exotic hors d'oeuvres. Next, he carried the mirror out of the study and into the living room, where he hung it in a conspicuous place. Alan's idea was simple, if not brilliant. The mirror would be made useful to him, after all. Not as directly as he had hoped, but indirectly. It would become a conversation piece. It would fascinate all sorts of people. Among his invited guests were a nationally syndicated gossip columnist, several show people of all sexes, tattletales of all ages, beautiful, vacuous ladies of the beau monde, a nice sampling of that worthless world Alan despised and admired. These creatures would be impressed and awed by his mirror. They would squeal and gibber and ask how the trick was done. They would question him about the mirror's origins. He would be deliciously cryptic, hinting at other dark, nameless forces at his beck and call. Word would spread by mouth and print about the mysterious Cagliostro in their midst. He would be lionized, feted, adulated. His lightest statement would carry weight. He would be a frequent guest on television talk shows, entering the homes of millions of people. He would be written up in magazines of huge circulation. His photo would appear everywhere. Publishers would offer him gigantic sums for his ghostwritten autobiography. He would be considered a sage. His advice on all matters would urgently be sought. He would be deemed delightfully dangerous, and people would fall at his presumably cloven feet, yearning to learn the arcane amatory techniques of which surely he was a master. He would become a legend in his own time, for in our epoch, Alan well knew, it is not necessary to be gifted or accomplished in order to attain legendary status. And perhaps some distant day when he was very old, he might sell the mirror for a vast amount of money. It would not be a bad life, he told himself, as he showered and prepared for the cocktail party. His guests began to arrive at about 6, and everything went as he'd wish. The mirror was a great success, and so was he. He saw the hot glitter in their eyes, heard their voices coursing with a kind of lust, filled his grateful lungs with the acrid perfume of glamour. Didn't glamour have a dazzling original meaning? He'd have to look it up and unabridged in the morning. All but a few of his guests were remarkably ugly, but it was a fashionable ugliness that passed for beauty in certain strata of society, and most of them were no longer young, although they strove to present the appearance of youth, aided by dyes, diets, corsets, injections, surgery, dentistry. One person of indeterminate age, Alan was fairly sure it was a woman, had hair bleached white, as the well-known sepulchre in skin the texture of cold gravy. Several of the men wore hair, not their own. Costly gems, throbbing with inner fire, pulsated on many a turkey neck and talon. They cavorted before the glass like performing apes. They grinned, frowned, rolled their eyes, stuck out their tongues. Some made obscene gestures. When the guests reluctantly left, one of them was persuaded to stay a little longer. She was beautiful, haughty, confident. Her face was on the cover of every fashion magazine. She had starred in a chic movie, and yet Alan possessed her 3 mere minutes after the last of the others had departed. It happened on the soft carpet in front of his marvelous, his glamorous mirror. Interesting experience that, he told himself. He might try placing the glass on the ceiling over his bed sometime, just as an experiment. He dismissed her somewhat later, after a cozy tete-a-tete supper, and only after solemnly promising he would call her the next day. Alone, Alan stood in front of the mirror, intensely pleased with himself. His reflection appeared to be pleased, too. Why not? The Alan of 5 seconds from now will be just as content as the Alan of now. He had won. In stories, the devil always wins by cleverly wording the contract and then sticking literally and precisely to that wording, observing the letter of it but violating the spirit. The devil has a brilliant legal mind and is the father of lawyers. By such a device, he had triumphed over Alan, temporarily. But Alan had turned the tables on him by making those 5 useless seconds useful. He had traded on human curiosity, cashed in on human gullibility, much in the manner of the devil himself. He had beaten the devil at his own game. He had bested him. Alan's image smiled broadly, and 5 seconds later, Alan did likewise. A few moments after that, however, there were 2 figures in the mirror. The devil's image appeared behind Alan's and tapped Alan's reflection on the shoulder. The real Alan, though, he felt nothing, quickly whirled around. But it was all right. There was no one behind him. He was alone. He immediately turned back to the mirror. The image of both the devil and Alan had vanished from the glass. It reflected an empty room. Icy sweat covered him in an instant as he recalled the condition of the contract. The mirror was for his private use, but Alan had put it on display, shown it to many others. He had violated the contract. The devil was therefore entitled to foreclose. Alan smelled a goat stink. He felt somebody tapped him on the shoulder. The Scallion Stone by Basil A. Smith. So you're on your way to Northumberland and the Farne Islands, are you? Said Atchison, and added with genial irony, "I suppose if it hadn't been for my having Prideaux Selby's catalogue, you'd never have broken your journey here at all." "Well, I did want to check up on one or two species," laughed the ornithologist, "and I don't dislike sleepy little Durham, you know. For night's lodging, within hearing of the cathedral chimes, I can even put up with a cantankerous old sinner like you." With such good-natured banter, and amid the comfortable surroundings of Atchison's library, a stranger, had there been one there hidden for some melodramatic reason, behind an armchair, would have had no difficulty in guessing that Drury was an old academic friend with a good claim to familiarity with his aged host. "Ah," reflected Atchison a few minutes later, as a pair of them, like good bachelors, sat watching the fire go out, "it's a long time since I did more than peep at Holy Island. Let's see, it's 50 years since the St. Cuthbert centenary. I remember crossing to the Farn about then." "Is there much archaeological stuff there?" asked Drury. "Any Cuthbert relics still?" 14th-century chapel in sight of the old boy's hermitage. "But unless you're keen, there's nothing very exciting," said Atchison. "It's the birds I'm after chiefly, of course," said Drury. "But while I'm there, I might as well kill two birds with one stone." "Talking of stones," responded the antiquary quite seriously, "you really ought to see the scallion stone." "What's that then?" asked the other. "Some ancient carved work?" "No," said Atchison. "It's more of a geological curio, in shape. Something between an oblong block and a wedge, about 5 feet in length and nearly 2 in breadth at its widest, I should say. Surface pretty smooth, with 5 elongated shapes like fossils standing out. The name comes from these, I suppose, for they look like spring onions, or scallions, as they call them in these parts. The whole thing's very curious." "And you say this is still to be seen on the island?" asked Drury. "I should be surprised if anyone's disturbed it," rejoined Atchison. "In fact, I doubt whether many people know of its existence. And with the amount of seaweed there is, they're not more likely to come across it by accident." Drury was quite intrigued, and very soon the two had forgotten their wine, while Atchison was drawing sketches and setting down directions which would help his guest to locate the phenomenon which seemed so well worth searching for. Drury enjoyed his expedition, and a few days later he was back in Durham, loaded with notes and photos of his beloved seabirds. Atchison had urged him to stay the night, and talk soon turned upon the scallion stone once more. "Yes, I did manage to get at it, after tearing up a load or two of channeled rack," said Drury. "In fact, I took a photo, too. I got a printout from it last night. You can have it if you like." Atchison was most interested when Drury brought down the photo for him. He scrutinized it for a minute, then put it down with knitted brow. "That's strange," he murmured. "It must have changed." "How do you mean?" asked Drury with some astonishment. "Well," said Atchison reflectively, "your photo here shows 5 scallions, all pretty much the same. Actually, when I saw this stone, 4 were complete, and the 5th was what I would call disfigured, almost as if wrenched and depleted at the end." "You're probably mistaken," said Drury, half amused. "Anyway, it seems a trivial point to keep in mind for all these years. Archaeology has made you mighty keen and observant, my boy." "Oh, it's not that," repudiated Atchison. "It's the legend that fixes it in my mind. I ought to have told you. It comes from Bede. You remember he tells us St. Cuthbert used to go from Lindisfarne into solitary retreat over on the Farn? There, with the sea to shut him off from the rest of the world, he spent his time in prayer and fasting. He was so engaged at the last period of his life, and when his monks came, fearing for his life, to look after him, they found the man dying. All he had by him were 5 onions, or at least 4, and a 5th which looked to be partly eaten." "So, so," said Drury with mild enthusiasm. "And now my photo here just fails to tally with the tale, but making the 5 complete. Are you sure it wasn't always the same, and this bit of detail from Bede has put a twist on your memory? It's no great matter, anyhow." Atchison was rummaging in a receptacle at his desk. Presently he handed to his friend another photo, old and discolored, but accurate enough in detail. "There," he said. "I took that myself when I was there. Now compare it with yours." Certainly there was a difference. It was as Atchison had said. The recent likeness showed 5 scallions, plump and alike. The old one showed four complete and one quite mutilated and apparently hollow and dank at the lower end. Very queer, admitted Drury. How could it come about? Broken fossils do not heal themselves, declared the serious Atchison. That's not a natural thing. By the look of you, one would think it boded something supernatural, teased Drury gaily. Atchison turned sharply on him then. That's what I mean exactly, he said with smart decisiveness. You surprise me, Atchison, replied the friend somewhat askance. I know. You're still a skeptic about such things. So was I, and should be still but for a nasty experience. And indeed, the whole thing hangs round this stone, and a certain man called Caladine. You'd better tell me about this, said Drury, quite animated now. I will, said Atchison, if you'll first poke that fire. It was in the Christmas vacation of 1886 that I came across Caladine. I had long promised myself a thorough survey of the castle at Bamberg, and the better to do so I was staying in the village at the Pend, I think it was called then, a little inn kept by old Colin Gray and his wife. I was scarcely more than an undergraduate in those days, and it was a real pleasure to me when I found another guest there, capable of providing some good company and conversation. I was at first puzzled to think why a young doctor, he would be in his early 30s, was secreting himself in such an outlandish place as the Northumberland coast, which, as you know, is uncommonly bleak and melancholy in the winter months. He told me at first he was spying out the land, with a view to setting up a country practice in those parts, having had to leave London through a nervous breakdown. As I afterwards learned, he was there for a double reason. On the advice of a criminal psychologist, he was seeking both to recuperate his health and to avoid public attention. You may have heard of the Crewe Dalton case, which gave the police such trouble but ended in a complete acquittal for Dalton in the trial. Well, Caladine was none other than Dalton, but he shall always be Caladine for me, poor devil. Well, we got on well the short time I was there. He was a man of cultured interest, especially in your line of natural philosophy, as we used to call it. Our talks together when we strolled on the seashore were often interrupted by little excursions on his part into the field of marine botany and zoology. He was also an uncommonly fine photographer, and I well remember how proud he was to have designed his own camera, which had a remarkable flashlight device for use in semi-darkness. This, together with his own skill, he most generously put at my service for making records of various architectural features at the castle. Indeed, it was one afternoon, at the end of such operations, that I first noticed something queer about him. I turned back to fetch my pipe, which I suddenly remembered was on the edge of one of the upper windows, and I left Caladine down in the inner bailey waiting for me. Now, it so happened that as I picked up the pipe, I caught a glimpse of him through the window. He was gazing out to sea, and I should have thought that natural enough, but for an open-mouthed attitude of fascination that seemed to have taken hold of him. Whatever he was looking at, I could not from my position see, but as I watched I suddenly saw him shudder, as if something revolting had been enacted before his eyes. When I rejoined him, he looked pale and said nothing. Somewhat inquisitive, I made excuse to look out seawards myself, but detected nothing unusual. "There is something haunting about the twilight on the coast, isn't there?" I observed. "How do you mean?" asked Caladine eagerly, then added, "I suppose, if you're of a poetic turn, you can imagine some fantastic things at times." "There's a sense of restraint which prevents a man from making pointed intrusions into another's thoughts on certain occasions, and my curiosity had to go unsatisfied. I felt that if Caladine had some sort of secret fear, it was probably due to his illness, and the best motto for a friend in such a case seemed to be quieta non movere. You will understand that the more when I tell you Caladine could, on occasion, be very violent and scornful, especially about matters of superstition. An instance will show what I mean. Gray, like most fisher folk, had quite a mental museum, as I should call it, of local tales and beliefs. One evening in the bar, his talk had been running on these lines when I came in. The topic, whatever it was, had evidently ended, and I was only in time to catch something about sea blood. Pricking up my ears, I asked what the mystery was about. Gray, to satisfy me, was going up to take up the thread again when Caladine, who had been sitting pensively in the corner, sprang up with an oath and broke the whole gathering up with a stormy tirade against such credulous nonsense. And after this he flung out of the room and I followed him in some anxiety, for it was obvious that the poor fellow's nerves were playing the devil with him again. Actually, however, he seemed to come round very cheerfully out of these fits. For days he was serenity himself, rambling along the shore in the mornings with his camera and often meeting me at the castle later. Only once was this harmony broken. It was in November when we were looking forward to some duck shooting. The weather had been very hard, and Gray, who was an expert in such matters, thought we might expect a flight or two coming seawards from the frozen ponds. Now, in this sport, as you know, a good deal depends upon your getting well hidden from sight, usually in a shelter pit dug in the sands, and so we found ourselves with spades, hawking a hole, as Colin called it, and readiness for the flights. The old man was choosing for himself a strategic point some yards away, while Caladine and I got to work with our shoveling. We had been at it silently for a time, and a goodish oblong cavity was beginning to take shape when Caladine drew in his breath with a gasp and suddenly stopped work. I had my back to him at the time, but turning round I saw him staring into the sand and trembling from head to foot. "Did you see that?" he said, pointing down, but I could see nothing remarkable. "It's gone now, of course," he added with relief, "but it gave me a queer turn." "Why? What did you see?" I asked in some bewilderment. "Oh, I know," he said despairingly. "It's my crazy nerves again. I suppose you think I'm mad." And there he sat with his handkerchief to his brow, looking very sick and tired, I thought, while Gray came up and looked silently on. We rallied him a bit, but he had no more appetite for sport that evening, so we got him back home and into a warm bed. I felt sure at the time that these hallucinations would be serious for Caladine sooner or later. Next day, however, he came down to breakfast, much refreshed, and the matter was scarcely referred to at all. A few days later, I had to be back in Newcastle, and when I left him, he seemed as sane as any man could be. Weeks passed without any news. Then one morning I got a letter from Gray, one of those clumsy, countrified epistles which only appear at times of domestic crisis, begging me to return to Bamberg at once to settle whether the doctor is quite wise in his head. It was a sorry tale the old man had to tell as we drove along in the dog cart after he had met me at the train. To cut a long story short, suffice it to say he had let Caladine persuade him, no hard matter, with an old sportsman, to get the guns out and have another try at the ducks, despite the lateness of the season. Gray had an idea of the flight lines, and so the pair of them were lying in wait one evening, some distance apart among the hollows, watching the sky. Then what should happen but Caladine gives a cry of terror just as the birds could be heard coming overhead. Of course, off they veered, out of shot, and left the old man cursing with disgust. But he ran to his companion nonetheless and found him lying dazed and shuddering. His plight was worse than ever before. Indeed, the upshot was that Caladine had been little better than a nervous invalid since. He became more than usually morose and developed such frightening symptoms that Gray and his wife began to watch him closely. They had heard him in his room at night, going and getting out of bed, strike a light and groan time and again. He sounded to always be washing at the bowl. Then one morning apologized to Mrs. Gray for leaving bloodstains on the sheets. "I meant to mention it before," he said. My nose, sometimes bleeds in the night. The strange thing is, there was no trace of blood about. But she dared not tell him so, for he was an awkward man to contradict at any time. She talked the matter over anxiously with her husband, and that day Colin wrote for me to come. When I arrived at the inn, Mrs. Gray was very thankful to see me, and I was equally relieved to learn that Caladine was upstairs, sound asleep. I could not help reflecting, as we sat at tea, upon the difficulties of my position. After what I had heard, it seemed plainly my duty to get Caladine away at all costs, but it was not a pleasant thing to realize that I had practically come to certify the wretched man as insane. On such an errand, one is not sanguine about the sort of reception that is in store. I had a delicate task before me, and one thing I wanted to do first was to talk matters over more fully with Gray. During our conversation in the dog cart, I thought I detected in him a note of understanding toward Caladine, as if the old man believed there was really something in these delusions. Moreover, my curiosity about that interrupted episode over sea blood was again demanding satisfaction. All told, I determined to probe the mystery at its most mysterious. As soon as Mrs. Gray had retired, after a weary day and several sleepless nights, to an early bed, applied old Colin with an extra drink or two, then got him to draw up to the fire and unburden his mind. A fine tale I got, to be sure. First, about sea blood. To say in local parlance that a person has got the sea blood meant, I found that he was contaminated by an insidious disease, resulting from a sort of curse. Local people, St. Cuthbert's Ain, as Gray would call them, were thought to be immune from this scourge because the ancient spirits of the coast had no power against those born within the pale of the saint's domain. Even strangers were not susceptible, except at certain times, like anniversaries, and then only in winter's months, so very rarely was a case expected. But tradition still held the day of St. Cuthbert's death to be an evil time each year. The last quite clear eruption of this curse fell, as I now learned, upon a little French girl, a refugee and orphan of one of the prisoners at Berwick, when Gray was a small boy. The end of the Napoleonic Wars it would be, for he was a good age in 87 when he told me all about this. I asked him what the symptoms were. All I remembered was that she could not sleep at all at nights for fear, but would cry out most pitifully about some ghastly vision. It was in these spasms that her feet were noticed to exude a sickly, blood-like sweat. The village folk then put it down to her going barefoot in the sands, a thing she did, it seems, quite often despite the cold. Rumor spread that the girl had trod on some evil creature of the sea. Then one old fishwife gravely recalled that this could be none other than the half-forgotten sea-blood curse. There was no cure, she said, except the victim should go across to Farne to touch the scallion in St. Cuthbert's name. And that was how I first came to hear about the stone of ours. Most folks, Gray said, were loath to make resort to such unearthly charms, but yet all felt a growing pity for the child. At last one day, in spite of some fear what Parson would say, they wrapped her up in shawls, and six men took out a boat for the island, so that they could at least try the power of this reputed spell and see if Mother Blackett was right about it after all. Alas, they never reached the island. Winds or currents tossed them back out of their course, and finally the boat capsized not far from where they started. Some of the crew always swore it was sucked down by supernatural forces, claiming the child. At any rate, despite all care and efforts, she alone was drowned. The poor thing never even rose, and search as they would, no trace of her was found. The wrecked boat, however, was at rare intervals partly visible some distance out beyond low tide. "It's an ill place," remarked Gray in conclusion, "and folks that's canny will give it a wide berth." We sat for a while, with no sound but the fire flames and the ticking of the clock in all the house, and the distant rustle of the eternal sea outside. I was trying to think out the bearing of the sinister tradition upon Caladan and his troubles when all at once we were both startled by the clicking of the latch on the stair door, and turned round to find Caladan himself, disheveled and half-dressed, coming toward us. There was an awful smile of desperation on his face, which, coupled with a false sort of calmness in his manner, made him seem almost a different person from the steady companion I had first known. "Sit down, the pair of you," he ordered. "I've overheard the whole delightful story. And I suppose, Mr. Atchison, you're going to call it very interesting and say how picturesque these old fancies are? Very pretty superstition, isn't it, my friend?" There was a leering hostility about the man which scared me for sanity, but I answered with some warmth. "Look here, Caladine, don't be a fool. No one believes in evil spirits nowadays. Queer things may have happened, but all this is heightened by subjective coloring, as any man knows." "Oh, yes," he said with mocking scorn. "What are you doing here, anyhow? You think I'm off my head, and you've come to tell me to pull myself together and haul me off to some genteel madhouse for the good of all concerned? Very kind of you, I'm sure, but I'll have you know my reason is as sound as yours." "Of course it is," I put in as patiently as I could, and then he snapped at me. "None of your soothing nonsense, either. My reason's sound, I tell you. But that does not save me from being under this hellish curse that Gray's been telling you about. I'm hounded to my grave by something devilish, and all your talking will not alter it." He sobbed and wept and pitiful hysteria, so I motioned Gray to bring some whiskey and tried to steady the poor chap. "It's no good coddling me," he raved. "I used to tell myself it was a case of nerves, and I was only seeing things. But now I know the affair is real. When Gray picked me up that night, I knew it was not fancy. As I'm alive, there was something both visible and, yes, good God, and tangible. I touched the brute, Atchison, like a snake there in the sand. And every night I wake to feel that horrid slime and find my hands all bleeding with it again. Yet because I cannot prove it to you, you think I'm just a ramping lunatic." His voice was rising again. I could not answer him and dared not ask for details from him in such a state. Moreover, as I looked at Gray, I knew the old man to believe the reality of Calladine's account. Then, on the spur of the moment, a way occurred to me that might, I thought, bring reason into play. "Now listen," I said. "You've had your say. Both you and Gray believe all this, but I tell you plainly I'm convinced there is no unearthly monster in the case. I'm convinced the sea blood is a delusion. I'm also convinced, Colin, that there is no such thing as your scallion stone or any other shred of fact behind this stuff. You can't prove anything." "And there you're wrong, sir," answered Gray quietly. "I've not seen the blood of Mr. Calladine, but there's them as did see it on that barn, and I've seen queerish sights around the shores times past." "What things have you seen then?" I demanded. "Well," said he uncomfortably, "they're hard to talk about. Movements in the sand, I'd say, and sometimes lights and shapes. Uncanny things, sir, particular near and at sea." "Until I see something myself," said I impatiently, "I cannot help thinking the pair of you are deluded. You can't show me anything tangible." "I think I could take you to the stone if need be, Mr. Atchison," said Gray. "Would you believe us then? It was about the time I took Mr. Nebby, our other vicar, to it that I saw those lights very plain at night. If I could get Mr. Calladine there and him to touch the stone, I'm sure, sir, he might be saved." I noticed Calladine's prick up his ears a bit, but he said nothing. I too was hesitant, but a moment's thought showed me my opportunity. "You really can find us the stone?" I said slowly, like one prepared to be convinced. "If you do prove right, I'm with you both. After all, I suppose it's not unreasonable. When there's a curse, there's a way of breaking it. If natural powers are really beaten, I'll join you to get this supernatural charm. I meet you with an open mind." "So cheer up, Calladine," I added. "We'll fathom this and have your mind free from the beastly scourge somehow. And when can we see this stone to start with, Colin?" "The sooner the better, but not a word to Mrs. Gray." The old man thought we could manage it next day and promised he would have a boat ready straight after breakfast if we wished, and so it was agreed. We drank up more cheerfully than we had done with Calladine since first I knew him. When I saw him up to bed again, I felt I could congratulate myself on having humored him at least some way toward recovery. I did not myself intend going to bed just then, despite the departure of Calladine and Gray, for it was not yet 10 o'clock. In all probability, I should have sat with a book for a while, but my inclinations were overruled by the inopportune looks and antics of Gray's young terrier, Rap. It seemed a pity on such a fine night to refuse giving the poor little fellow a stroll, so I took up my hat and stick, and off we went. While Rap was pursuing his own particular investigations here and there, I too was trying to sniff out a trail of sense and satisfaction in the dark corners of my mind. I began, of course, to seek justification for my role of benevolent hypocrite. These old wives' tales of grace were too fantastic for my serious credence, but this I thought might well be a case where, psychologically speaking, Beelzebub might cast out Beelzebub. And for Calladine's sake, it seemed worth trying. To cure a deluded sufferer, it could certainly not be very wrong for me to pretend to share the delusion. So I thought. Then, for some unknown reason, I began to toy with the matter in a reflective rather than a practical mood. Perhaps it was the struggling moonlight softening the atmosphere and my common sense at the same time. I tried in vain to dismiss the significance of Gray's having seen something as well as Calladine's. It must be superstitious imagination, I told myself. But who had started the process? Had Calladine influenced Gray, or had the gossip and attitude of Gray and his neighbors borne in upon Calladine? Superstition is curiously infectious. Would anyone ever have seen a ghost? if he had not first heard of someone else seeing one. By this time, our walk had taken us almost to the castle. My steps or raps, being on familiar ground, decided their own route, and I soon found myself looking out to sea from the inner bailey. It was the spot where Caladine had stood when I glanced at him from the window and first noticed him with that queer, fascinated stare, and I was looking out where he had looked, towards the Longstone light. It was about high tide, and I was taking a drowsy interest in the rhythm of the rollers, crumbling to whiteness in the dim moonlight, when something made me strangely alert. A little beyond what would be a low water mark when the tide ebbed, there seemed to be a patch of submerged light, like a pool of phosphorant green, shimmering on the seabed. From it there came, straggling limply in all directions, a number of short, root-light lines. But one line, like a huge proboscis, thicker than the rest, was pointed shoreward. To all appearance, it was anchored there, for not only did it heave and waver in the water, but I caught glimpses of it shining here and there across the sands. But my eye was mainly on that central ganglion in the sea with its floating, nervous threads. Now as I looked, the color changed and the whole shape shone, magically transfused with crimson, like some colossal lobster seen through the thick, distorting medium of a bull's-eye windowpane. Then suddenly up shot those cruel feelers. A seabird shrieked. I saw an eddy of dispersing wings above the bloody spot, and all was gone. In a twinkling, the glowing light had died, and every mark of the apparition vanished. I waited, staring, to assure my wits, but nothing further happened. Yet Rap was back, cowering at my side, no doubt disturbed as I was by that harrowing scream. Back to the inn we went, and I had a strange thought to ponder on the way. If superstition fools the senses to such a pitch, then who is sane? All my earlier self-assurance had deserted me. When I got to bed, it was to find but intermittent sleep. A haunting spirit of misgiving brooded over me and cast a shadow on the outcome of the morrow's doings. Events moved rapidly that day. First, when we woke, our plans had gone awry. Caladine was ill and haggard beyond description. After some extra hellish dream, he said, some nightmare on the fate of that dead girl. He was completely demoralized once more and in no mood to keep our bargain of the previous night. I saw her beckoning to me, poor little wretch. As the boat sank and the waters were drowning her cries, he muttered, I know this is an evil day for me out there. That sea moan is sounding in my head like a ghost call. Let's all stay here till it goes off. After the day, I know I shall be all right again. Poor Caladine. I shall never forget those words of his and that imploring look. What devil drove me to make light of such an appeal? Oh, yes, I soothed and sympathized all right. I coaxed him off to rest again. I even fetched tobacco for him from the shop. But in my heart, I secretly determined I was going to see that stone myself. Gray had the boat all ready, and it might be many a day before the sea was again suitable to cross. And then I must be back to town next day at least, I argued to myself. My own experiences had wrought in me a fascination close on frenzy to see how and know the most that could be known. And soon, so deadly soon, I knew it. Within an hour, I left him dozing, God forgive me, and we went. I need not tell you of that little voyage in the morning sun. You've been yourself, nor need I tell you of the stone and of my childish wonderment at seeing it in fact, as Gray had said. There were the four completed bulbs and the fatal fifth so dank and gaping. I well remember that, and then of course I took my fill of satisfaction by photographing it as well. But was I satisfied? I wondered. What was there yet in store? I felt as one who hears a prelude played and waits the fall of chords that marks the onset of the major theme. We should have brought him with us, sir, I heard Gray murmur in reproach. And then at once I saw the lines of fate converging on him, my poor friend Caladine. A sudden guilty fear welled up inside me now. Old Collins' thought was doubtless of the man being cured by touching the stone, but in my mind I saw a thousand chances of some untoward act he might be led to by his crazy brain while we were dallying there. Into the boat we tumbled, and as we rowed, I heard anew those ominous words. I know this is an evil day for me out there. The afternoon sky was darkening noticeably as we rowed. A yellow dullness lowering in the air boded the rising of an unseasonable storm. No rain, however, had fallen when we got to land, but Mrs. Gray came running out to meet us from the house. "Mr. Caladine's gone out," she panted. "Can't you find him, Colin? A before the storm comes on. If he's caught, I'm sure he'll get his death. We took the coat she gave us and hurried down the beach, and as we ran, I felt it was a race against a darker foe than rain. At least Gray spotted him. Indeed, but for surface mist, we should have seen him earlier from our boat. Good Lord, cried Gray, the man's stark mad. Look there, he's at the wreck. In the distance, we could see the black hulk of the fatal boat in which the girl had drowned. An exceptionally low tide, due to the equinox, no doubt, had brought about one of those rare occasions when the sea exposed this melancholy hulk, and that small figure moving about was surely Caladyne, clamoring on the half-buried vessel. Dang the fool! What's he tampering with? Groaned Colin, with a curse. He knows to keep away. I told him there's something wicked there, and now the tide will cut him off. As we approached, I noticed Caladyne had got his camera in his hand, and now we heard him call. By Jove! I've made a choice discovery, Atchison. Queer sort of sea plant with abnormal features and quite huge. Seems to be growing through the timbers down there. Yes. All right. But come on, man. You look like being caught, I cried. The tide's already here. Gray had dropped back somewhat and was scanning the blackening clouds. There'll be a clap just now, sir, he bawled. But neither of us could get quite to the boat because of a shore pool engulfing it on our side. The first fringe of the approaching tide was now lapping also on the seaward side, once Caladyne apparently had come upon his prize. Nor had we any view into the boat as it was shored up on its side, facing away from us. All we could see in that livid daylight were the rotting timbers, and Caladyne slithering around the gunwale and fumbling with a flashlight pan. "I must just get one exposure of it somehow," he yelled, strapping the camera to a withered rowlock. Moment's silence followed then. Good God, it's... One agonizing scream, a blinding flash, and I felt myself thrown headlong in the wet, quaking sand with a mortal crack and roar of thunder in my ears. The next thing I knew was being dragged to my feet by Gray amid the drenching torrents of a cloudburst. Giddily, I pulled myself together and joined with him in calling, Caladyne! Hey, Caladyne! And wading about in the swirling sea, all our cries were in vain. Nothing could we find save bits of wreckage floating here and there. From one I snatched the fatal camera, still strapped to it. In haste, I went for help while Colin stayed to search. Even when men and lanterns in a boat arrived, it was a fruitless task. Splinters of wood and fragments, what seemed like bloody seaweed, all beefy red and gristly, and that was all. There was no sign of unhappy Caladyne. With the lanterns flickering, we took our last look across the evening sea, and I could not help but muse upon my vision of the previous night when the water, like a witch's oils, burned green and blue and white. Death by misadventure was all that could be safely said of my poor friend's fate. The only evidence was a fresh stripped skeleton found 3 days later. But the fisher folk put the whole tragedy down to malevolent powers. Talk turn on spiritual forces incarnate in some carnivorous sea plant of monstrous dimensions. Folklore was rife about St. Cuthbert's fiends and sea blood and the like. The sexton, too, who had been digging a grave that tragic afternoon, soon had a tale to tell. I got it from the parson later. No doubt it had gathered details by transmission several times. This fellow had, so Mr. Ainsley said, often noticed a reddish slime in the ground when he was excavating. Beetles and worms seemed greatly drawn to this stuff from all directions, and he could not make out where it oozed from. He had never liked the look of it himself, and so had kept pretty clear. Besides, it had a most obnoxious stench, he said. Now, on the afternoon of Caladyne's death, this man was in the graveyard at his work when the ground began to quake and he saw a substance, not in the old quarter, where you might expect it among the vaults, but where the recent burials had been. He rushed to where the soil was broken most and was in time to see a curious sight. There were his beetles and other insects by the hundreds making through a ruddy patch of soil toward a writhing length of something like an elephant's trunk. It gleamed with a phosphorant light, he said, and seemed to have tough veins pulsating along it, but it lashed out so violently that in a moment it was gone. He saw what looked like tawny-colored bristles twitching on the thing, with insects being impaled upon them and sucked into scaly apertures within the trunk. But what horrified the fellow most were tentacles stuck piercing through a newly buried coffin, for purposes so obvious and evil. It must have been a gruesome sight, And it always set me wondering about that root-like line I saw the night before the tragedy, running from the sea across and under the sands, and also about what Calladine must certainly have seen and touched when out with Gray the other time. I should think less of this but for a startling thing that came from that camera of his. One of the demonstrators at the laboratory, for amusement it seems, betook himself to develop the plates when it arrived along with Calladine's other things in Newcastle. Anyway, what should Dr. Angus bring me one morning but a photograph of the very sight that Calladine beheld at the moment of his death? If you'll kindly reach down that large book, that old one in a faded leather, on my cabinet, you will find the same photograph inside. Drury had soon seen enough. Even after a glass of brandy and soda, he was still shivery for some time at the thought of those countless layers of rank, concentric lobes, and the unfolding bunch of antennae, just glimpsed there in the very instant of disclosing that inane and meager face within the vortex. Poor devil, he shuddered. What did he take it for at first? Some monstrous species of Drosera? That stuff like fungus reminds me of those ghastly frilled lizards they have in Australia. But then these writhing tombs? If you think of an ultra-ghoulish octopus as well, you've still not sized this nightmare up. There's something horrible beyond. Yes, mused Atchison solemnly. Something beyond? I almost feel that you're right, said Drury reluctantly. But I don't quite grasp your supernatural basis for this. Well, answered Atchison, even in the modern texts we have Bede's word for it that Farne Island was haunted in St. Cuthbert's time. But I confess it was a reference in his antiquated folio here that first made me read between the lines. Look at it yourself. Here he passed his friend the book in which the ugly photograph had long been kept. After glancing with some curiosity at the title page, a discreet inquiry into the spiritual topography of the northern parts of England by the Reverend Dr. William Danby, 1579. Drury turned to the place inside, which Atchison had found and read. Evil report was known of the same island of Farne in old time. Beda well noteth it, spiritum malignorum frequentia humanae, habitoni minus accommodis. Again, where he write of the sojourn of the holy Cuthbert, thereupon he beareth witness how that afore his servant of the Lord no man was there ever so bold to dwell on this island alone by reason of the foul fiends there resident. Truly, as he says, no fantasy so grievous but this good man by spiritual striving might put to flight, howbeit the faithful Hereford, when he come to him on the Farne, find as his dying master sore pressed. That holy man had there but 5 onions beneath the truckle bed, that which he bringeth forth as token of meat enough to keep him lively. Thereat quoth Hereford, methought one of them to be a little gnawed, yet certainly not more than half bitten upon. Then spoke the saint, never in all my sojourn in this island did my enemies so hardly plague me as upon these last 5 days. Nor yet, says Hereford, was I bold enough to ask him what manner persecutions he thus endured. Ah, I begin to see it now, murmured Drury in reverie, as his host rose and put both book and photograph away. That's where your scallion stone comes in. So, demon number 5, that gave old Cuthbert the slip, has done his damnedest and been put to rest. But what a sinister thing to know, when you stood that morning looking at that last fossil, clammy and vacant, that thing was still at large. Aye, said Atchison. And what of Calladine, who knew it? He asked me once what sort of hell-hag an amphibian and vampire would be to dream about.